Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This podcast contains intense subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
On Thursday, September 9th, 1976, at approximately 3 p.m., Detective Spears and myself went to the Ralph Otto residence to request that he, Ralph Otto, take a polygraph examination administered by Al Johns, state investigator. Otto indicated that he would not take a polygraph examination under any circumstances and that it would be fruitless in an attempt to get him to do so. Otto asked, "Are you accusing me of murdering my wife?" I advised him on the contrary. I just wanted to know if he knew of anything of her disappearance. Otto indicated and put his finger on my chest and said, "If you think it, you're going to have to prove it against me." I again asked Otto if he had anything to do with the disappearance of his wife, and he advised that he did not. I suggested that he take the polygraph examination to show the truthfulness of his statements, and he again advised he would not.
From the pages of the Reporter's Notebook. This is Still, Season 2. I'm your host, Gary Anderson. In the last episode, we talked about Patricia Otto's disappearance late in the evening of August 31st or early in the morning of September 1st, 1976. On September 2nd, the day after Ralph told everyone that his wife had left him, Ralph started telling people that he didn't want Patty to come back. He said he had changed the locks on the house and on the white Chevy station wagon Patty normally drove, in case she ever tried to return. We're going to spend quite a bit of time in this episode delving into Ralph and Patty Otto's personalities, their marriage, and their friendships. All of these things strongly influenced the chain of events leading up to and following Patty's disappearance. So, let's start with Ralph. Ralph Otto was born in 1934. In the little town of Craigmont, Idaho. An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Like most newborns, Ralph curled his tiny fingers at the shock of his new, unfamiliar surroundings. But there was something different about the way he formed his fists. Ralph was already swinging for a fight. The second oldest of four kids, Ralph was raised in a thrifty household by parents who had eloped during the Great Depression and spent most of their years barely scraping by. but Ralph had no intention of settling for a meager portion from life. From a young age, Ralph learned to be crafty. He would charm, cheat, and steal to get what he wanted, and would bare-knuckle his way out of a situation if he got caught. This is Ralph's youngest daughter describing him.
But he was small. He was a small man. And I've heard from his friends that they think that had something to do with why he was so aggressive with everyone. He wanted to pick fights. You want to fight with me? You want to fight with me? And I'm like, I've never been in a physical fight in my life. I can't imagine fighting with my friends that you love and adore. Why is he picking fights with them? They would just say, he'd drink his whiskey and he'd want to fight everybody.
Sometimes Ralph wanted something simply because it belonged to someone else. He didn't always want to keep it. He just didn't want anyone else to have it. Provoking fury was a sport for Ralph. In early August of 2021, Christine Hughes, Karen Shaw Anderson, and I sat down with Ralph's sister-in-law, Dolores, who goes by Dodie.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
Come on in.
Oh, you're gonna wait?
She was married to Ralph's younger brother, Ray.
My Uncle Dwight, my Uncle Gary Anderson,
he's the sound man. I want you to go in the room because it's cooler in there. We
chatted with Dodie at her kitchen table. So Ralph was your brother-in-law.
Right.
Right. Tell us about the relationship between you and Ray and Ralph and Patty. What kind of...
There was none. Ralph absolutely hated my husband. He was extremely jealous of him.
Dodie told us a story that illustrated the brothers' relationship. In high school, Ray had saved enough money working at a grocery store to buy himself a blue letterman's jacket.
And he came home from work one time, and here's Ralph in his garage under the car, all this grease with Ray's coat on. And Ray asked him, "What are you doing wearing my coat?" And he got up and just beat the holy heck out of him. And Ray never lifted a hand to him. Never.
Ralph and Ray's father, Arthur Otto, folks called him Art, worked for the highway department before landing a job at the Potlatch Lumber Mill. Arthur died of a heart attack when he was 39, 2 months before Ralph's 17th birthday. At the time, Ralph's older brother Jerry had recently moved out, so Ralph's mother Marjorie had three children at home to care for on her own. This is Ralph's sister, Marcy, talking.
My father died young, and some of the kids wanted to blame one of the other kids. So Ralph and I were at odds because I was a teenager at that certain point, and I'd ran away from home only a month before my dad died. And that was bad, you know, it was all put on me, and those were the bad times at that point in my life.
Just a few months after Ralph's high school graduation in 1952, he got married. He was 18, and his bride lied about her age on their marriage license. Joy would still be 14 for another month and a half. She had claimed to be 16. Ralph and Joy were married only a year when Ralph's brother Jerry, who was also married and now the father of a baby girl, drowned at a family outing while saving his wife and mother, who were swimming in the Clearwater River. Jerry was only 20 years old. By all accounts, the tragedy hardened Ralph even more. This is Marcy again.
Ralph had a tendency to leave a bad past behind him, and he could be mouthy, and you just want to, you know, get him out of the way. And but from the time we were just young children, my younger brother and I were real close, but nobody could be real close to Ralph.
Marcy talked to us about a time Ralph threw an axe at her.
Well, he threw an axe across the creek and hit me in the head. And the parents thought that they were going to lose me. But I never, ever blamed Ralph. because it's, you know, he made a mistake as a family all stuck together. My dad wouldn't let anyone blame Ralph.
Those who weren't related to Ralph by blood had a harder time forgiving his temper. Joy divorced him in 1965, but just a few months after their divorce was finalized, they remarried each other. Then, a few months after that, they divorced again. Idaho hadn't yet passed a no-fault divorce law, so blame had to be assigned to one or both of the spouses in order for a judge to grant a divorce. In both cases, Joy sued Ralph for the divorce, citing extreme cruelty as the cause. We were going to interview Joy for this podcast, but she changed her mind at the last minute. We do know that she and Ralph went their separate ways after the second divorce. They had no children together. By then, Ralph had established himself in Lewiston as a skilled but shifty auto mechanic. This is Ralph's sister-in-law, Dodie, again.
And he was a crook, I guarantee you. He had his good sides, but most of them were bad. He'd work on somebody's car. He'd jack up the prices so bad on the repair job that they couldn't afford to pay for it, so he'd end up owning the car. And that's just, he always say, what is mine is mine, and what is yours is mine. That was his opinion. He lied. He'd tell lies about his brother.
Ralph was always working on schemes to make more money. He and a friend bought a small island not far from Lewiston on the Clearwater River. Their plan was to turn rock on the island into gravel. Another friend, who owned a rock-crushing company, brought in equipment for the job, but river flooding halted the process after only a day and a half. Work didn't resume for months, and then only restarted briefly. Ralph ordered an end to the rock crushing and only repaid his friend, the equipment operator, a portion of what was due. Ralph was sued for breach of contract. It was the end of the friendship, but not the last word for Ralph. Nor was the sale of gravel Ralph's only hope of income. He also rented out and sold miscellaneous heavy equipment, allowing him to earn highway contracts to help clear trees and debris from mountain roads covered by landslides. He was doing more than getting by. For at least 2 years, he brought in the equivalent of a six-figure salary in today's dollars. He used those earnings to buy his parents' house from his mother, who had since remarried. And he turned what was a modest farmhouse into a bachelor pad, complete with red shag carpet, a console stereo, a player piano near the entryway, and an oversized painting of a nude woman on another wall. Some of the upgrades Ralph paid for, but his family told us that a lot of the materials for the renovations were stolen from construction sites around town. Rumors also abounded that Ralph got revenge on the man who sued him by seducing that man's sister. In the years after his divorce from Joy, Ralph went on the prowl, pumping coins into jukeboxes at the local bars, lavishing women with gifts, and throwing gossip-worthy soirees at his 2,000-square-foot home.
I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You know it's me when I come through your town. I'm gonna ride around in style, I'm gonna drive everybody wild, 'cause I'll have the only one there is around.
Ralph was on the lookout for a very specific type of woman. He had a weakness for petite blondes with a slim build. Joy had fit that mold perfectly. So did Bonnie Shopbell, who you heard about in the last episode. Bonnie was a blue-eyed, platinum-haired beauty who had recently left a bad relationship when she got involved with Ralph. This is Ralph's daughter talking again.
He had to have been very charming, and he was definitely very good-looking when he was younger. He was a good-looking man, and I just don't think he saw that man in the mirror. I think he continued to see that strapping, high school stud, 5'8" stud, And his brother, Jerry, is like 6'2" and Ray is taller. And I think he feels inferior to them. So he's got to be stronger and tougher physically than them because he's smaller than them. That would be my analysis.
Bonnie and her kids stayed with Ralph for a brief time in the late 1960s while she got back on her feet. From what she's told us, it's clear that Ralph wanted to do more than help her. He paid a teenage girl who lived up the street to watch her kids while he took Bonnie out on the town. Bonnie told us that Ralph constantly referred to her as his Bonnie, which made her uncomfortable. But Ralph was also generous with her. He worked hard to impress her during their courtship, but Bonnie still wasn't that interested. The teenage babysitter Ralph hired to watch Bonnie's kids was interested, though. She was Patricia Lee O'Malley, soon to be Patty Otto.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
She also got to remember how young her mom was. She didn't get to.
That's Patty's sister, Alice Mills, talking. As you listen in to this interview, you'll also hear Patty's youngest daughter, and they'll refer to Marcy, Ralph's sister.
I know when she first would go down there, she babysat for Bonnie. Bonnie is the one that was living with him. Mm-hmm. And that's where it started. She would babysit. And then when she moved out, she just kept going down and she'd clean his house and run his errands. And
okay, and that's what Marcy was saying. She was cleaning the house. Mm-hmm. She said,
and that's
kids.
When,
yeah, they were.
So apparently that's when, because I remember when I found out that they were having a thing, I didn't believe it. Vicky knew. Patty had told Vicky, I guess, or something.
Vicky is Patty's other sister. She asked Alice to speak on her behalf for this podcast.
And I said, no, I did not believe it until she admitted it to me. These are things back then that I'm thinking that my sister, no, she's not that stupid. But now I'm finding how manipulative and what your dad needs to say, and he would do this for her and say things, and she was inexperienced.
Young.
Yeah. And we were raised strict. So, and it's a neighbor. You know, he's a few houses down the street, yeah.
As I look. Patricia Lee O'Malley was born August 4th, 1952, in Lewiston, 11 days after Ralph had married his first wife, Joy. Patty's dad, Tom, was a Lewiston fire captain. Her mom, Toots, worked at a bank and then got a job out at the lumber mill. Patty had two sisters and a brother, Tom Jr. The three girls were especially close.
The three of us were born within 3 years.
Okay.
Patty is only 13 months older than me.
Goodness.
So we were close growing up. I mean, we always shared a bedroom. And so one of us got in trouble. We all got in trouble. There was that closeness of sisters. I mean, you grew up, we played dolls, we played Barbies. And but even though her and I were only 13 months apart, she let me know that she was my older sister. I had to obey her. when we were little kids growing up, we had a neighborhood with quite a few kids in it. And we would, all of us, you know, back then, we'd go out and we had to stay on our block. But we could go around our block, and we had wagons and our bikes, and we'd tie them together and have wagon frames. And But we had a lot of friends that we played with, and we did a lot with our other family, get-togethers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why she was always so... We raised family was really important.
Patty was 18 in 1970 when she walked down the aisle of Lewiston's Trinity Lutheran Church and pledged to be faithful to Ralph forever. Ralph was 35 at the time. They honeymooned in California and Mexico. A year later, Ralph and Patty's first child, Natalie, was born. Only 2 years after that, in November of 1973, Patty delivered the couple's youngest daughter, Dallas. In the next 3 years, Ralph and Patty fought, separated, reconnected, and fought some more. As you heard in the last episode, the longest separation between Ralph and Patty began in the fall of 1975. That's when she got a job to help support her daughters and herself.
No, I don't think she wanted to work. I think she wanted to stay home, raise her kids, be a wife. I think the only time, like I said, going to work is when they separated, and then I think she went to business school because she knew sooner or later she was going to have to support him, because I don't think she planned on staying with Ralph.
And then one night, while still separated from Ralph, Patty went to Van's Club. At the bar, she saw Randy Benton playing guitar on stage with his band, Moving Country.
Well, I seen her in there, so I went and talked to her. We've known each other for a very long time.
Patty took Randy back to the place where she and her daughters were living. She told him that if Ralph showed up, he'd have to leave. Randy later told police that when she said that, he decided to leave right then and there. It wasn't the sort of situation he wanted to get mixed up in. Less than a year later, he learned that Patty had gone back to Ralph, and now she was missing. Police also told Randy that Ralph was threatening to kill him. They advised him to leave town if he could.
The people that told me they were serious about it.
Okay. Did you leave town after that?
No, not right away. I started carrying a pistol. They told me to. And so I started carrying a pistol for a while until I could get... And then shortly after that, in that fall, I moved to Alaska.
Because
my brother came down and somebody told him my family was trying to protect me, I think.
So I have
so
to...
So my brother convinced me to go to Alaska.
So I have to ask, because there have been so many rumors about what could have happened to Patty. And some people believe that she went to Alaska or she went to Canada. Did you ever see her again after she disappeared?
No, I did not.
You may be wondering now, who told us that Patty had gone to Alaska and Canada? It was Ralph's sister-in-law, Dodie, the woman married to his brother, Ray. This is where the rumors and theories start going in strange directions. Not long after Patty disappeared, Dodie and her husband hired a private investigator to try to find Patty to prove that Ralph couldn't have killed her. They said they believed she was still alive. We haven't seen any of the notes that private investigator Jack Prim gave to the couple after he completed his work for them. But Dodie shared with us pages and pages of notes she and Ray compiled during that time. Some of the notes indicate what Prim told them in his report, and other notes were related to Dodie's own amateur investigation. In her notes, Dodie said someone she knew told her he overheard a truck driver say that he gave Patty a ride to Alaska, and he knew who she was with. Dodie also told us that the PI gave them some shocking news.
So we finally hired a private investigator, and he'd worked on it for about 2-3 days, and they came.
This is Dodie talking.
To Ralph's house, and he told me that he found out that Patty was a high-class call girl, that she had a sugar daddy. And I said, "What's a sugar daddy?" I had no idea what a sugar daddy was. She's into drugs, high-priced cowgirl, and she had a sugar daddy. And I wouldn't believe it. I said, that's not true. That's not Patty. But anyway, to make a long story short, there is just evidence to prove that that's exactly where she was. And we have a statement from this gentleman here who just passed away, Steve Eichen. His wife, Debbie Lobe, and it's all in here, is the one we got the handwritten note from stating that they had found her in Canada. A doctor had sent information that he recognized her from a poster, and she was under drugs, and she was into prostitution. And that's the last I know, so she was in Dawson Creek, Canada.
Dawson Creek.
And I truly believe that she got wrapped up with the wrong people, and they took her out of here and put her into human trafficking. And where they put her from Dawson Creek, Canada, I have no idea.
We were dubious, to say the least. Doty's claims that Patty was a prostitute sounded pretty far-fetched. But we didn't want to overlook anything, so we asked a few more people, including Ron Rohde. Ron babysat Natalie and Dallas not long before their mother disappeared. He was a teenager then, and his dad had been a friend of Ralph's. This is Ron.
He initially talked to my dad. They said they wanted a boy babysitter because they didn't trust girls. And so he initially got a hold of my dad and got me lined up to babysit for him. And he would get a hold of me. I just lived a few blocks down the street.
Okay.
And we never really dealt with Patty at all.
Okay. Do you remember about what year it was that you started babysitting for them?
God, I couldn't even tell you.
Okay. Do you remember how old the girls were?
Dallas was just little in diapers. She was probably 2, maybe at the most.
Okay.
And Natalie was probably 5. I'm not sure what the age difference was between them.
Okay. And so what were your impressions of the family, of Ralph and Patty? Did they get along?
Well, you know, it was when I first started babysitting for them, when I first met them, everything was great. It seemed like, I mean, they were happy, perfect couple. And then it spiraled downward pretty fast after maybe 6 months. And it got pretty bad at the end. I didn't see Patty a lot. She was always in the house. I was always dealing with Ralph. But, you know, just he became a horrendous alcoholic and was miserable. And, things kind of spiraled out of control pretty fast.
Now, you said that things got pretty horrendous pretty fast with his drinking and stuff. Can you describe any of that to me?
Well, I mean, the whole story, Patty was a wild child. And it's as simple as that. You know, and Ralph was probably twice her age.
Mm-hmm.
And the rumors got around that she was having a pretty wild life outside of their marriage. And I'm sure it was true. And then Ralph found out that she was working as a prostitute. There was a couple police detectives in Lewiston, but it was common knowledge that they were running a call girl ring out of the top floor of the Tapadera Hotel. And Patty and Dwayne Ayler were kind of seeing each other. And then Ralph found out that she was working for them as a prostitute.
Dwayne Ayler was a police captain and was working with Tom Saline on the investigation into Patty's disappearance.
Okay. So how often would she be working as a prostitute? Did you get an impression about that?
I have no idea. I was always around during the day working on my cars. I never knew what went on at night.
Okay.
I just remember Ralph one day coming out to the shop. I mean, when all this started happening, she started running around and he knew about it. That's when he started drinking, I think, kind of to try to smooth it over, and his drinking just got out of control. He was, I mean, he was drunk first thing in the morning all day long. And I don't know if that was his way of dealing with it or what, but he came out to the shop one day and was just, it scared me. I'd never seen him like that before, and he was just spitting mad. And he was telling me that he'd found out. He said, "How would you like to find out that your wife's a freaking prostitute?" And he said, "I just found that out." And he said, I'm going to kill her. And it was like a few days later, she was gone.
We wanted to dig more into this prostitution rumor, since we had heard it from more than one person. We did some online research, Googling Lewiston, Idaho prostitution. As strange as it was, the two seemed to be indelibly tied together. So we reached out to an expert on Lewiston's history to learn more. It turns out that Lewiston was actually once a hotspot for prostitution, but that was decades before the time frame we're discussing. Here's historian Stephen Branting talking about it.
Well, I think I can speak to that pretty quickly. It wasn't an issue. Prostitution had pretty well been stamped out in Lewiston by the mid-1950s. It was an old problem that dated from the territorial days when the city was founded in May of 1861. And it had gone through some pretty raucous days. There were up to 18 brothels here at one time. More brothels than churches, I should say. But by the late 1950s, and I had moved here and was being educated here at the time, there was, there were a lot of jokes about prostitution. We never had streetwalkers here. They were always houses of prostitution, but no streetwalking. The police wouldn't allow it. The police were really kind of on the take in many ways for decades and decades until that was finally stamped out. And it moved, some of the prostitution problems moved into Clarkston, Washington, across the state line, which the two cities are, other than a river, would be abutting each other.
So, even if the rumors about Patty being a prostitute were false, there was enough real history of prostitution in Lewiston to understand why some people, especially those who were old enough to remember it, might believe it to be true, that Patty had gotten involved in it. Here's retired police detective Tom Saline's take on the prostitution theory.
At that time period in Orfino, Idaho, they had a house of ill repute called the Rex, and it was the only one that I know of in the area. And further upriver earlier, they had one at Maggie's Bend. So prostitution was allowed in Clearwater County, but not in the Lewiston area. But as a house of ill repute in Lewiston, there may have been a case here or there, but there was nothing with anything of that would bring anybody's attention to it. No. Patty was, in my opinion, Patty was not a prostitute. She's a 24, 26-year-old young girl, and she has two kids. And she's close with her family. She's close with her parents. She wants to get her further her life and get an education. And she's working on that. And she's, to all our knowledge, was a wholesome young woman. Now, she may have had some time with someone else. And that was fairly popular in the 70s. With her being a runaround whore, I would say a zero chance.
Then there's the angle of Patty having an affair with a police captain. It appears that Doty and a man named Emil Fleiger may have been the people who originally told Ralph that Patty had been hanging out at the Woodshed Bar in Winchester with Dwayne Ayler. Fleiger had helped with construction work on the Woodshed Bar and knew a lot of people in Lewiston. Doty insists that Fleiger told her he saw Patty and Dwayne Ayler together at the bar. Patty's sister Alice doesn't believe it. but she never knew about the fling between Patty and Randy, so it's possible she'd be unaware if Patty had other extramarital relationships. The rumor about Patty and the police captain became so widely circulated that at one point, state investigators, who began assisting with the search for Patty Otto, asked Lewiston police about it. Duane Ayler submitted a written statement swearing that he had never met Patty and had never been involved with her. A new Lewiston investigator, who had been assigned to Patty's case in 1987, interviewed Fleiger because Doty was still insisting that police follow up on that angle. Here's producer Christine Hughes reading a portion of the report written by that police officer.
My purpose in contacting Fleiger was to verify the accuracy of several statements concerning the Patricia Otto missing person case as related to you by Mrs. Dolores Doty Otto. Upon initial contact with Fleiger, I did verify that he was, in fact, a former employee of a Mr. Jack Rohde, a contractor who was responsible for some of the construction on the Woodshed Tavern in Winchester, Idaho. Fleiger also indicated he was, in fact, familiar with Patty Otto and her family, the O'Malleys. Fleiger further confirmed that he does know Duane Ayler. Fleiger indicated he does recognize Ayler by sight. However, he has not seen him for approximately 10 to 12 years. I asked Fleiger if there was any validity to Dolores Otto's statement that he had observed Patty Otto and Duane Ayler together at the Woodshed Tavern in Winchester, Idaho, a short time before Patty's disappearance. Fleiger indicated he could positively not say in any way that Otto's statement had any validity.
The report said Emil Fleiger had worked for Jack Rohde, who was the father of Ron Rohde, the Otto's babysitter. The rumors about Patty seemed to be growing like a real-life game of telephone. Why would Doty be so convinced that Patty was still alive and that Ralph hadn't harmed her, especially if she thought Ralph was a crook and knew he had a bad temper? We'll get to that. If Patty had, in fact, simply left Ralph and the girls, we could see why Ralph would no longer want Patty back, especially if he truly believed she was a prostitute or had been having an affair with a member of the police force, one of the cops who was investigating him. This is Ron Rohde again.
After she disappeared, the police started hounding him. I mean, they were after him. So, yeah, they were hounding him relentlessly. But he was just constantly drunk. So nothing really changed. Yeah, I mean, he didn't even talk about her to me. And they just harassed him. They harassed me because I was involved with him. It was pretty bad. The cops were pretty corrupt back then, I mean, super corrupt. Yeah, like say two of the head detectives were running a prostitution ring. But I'm sure Duane Ayler was having an affair with Patty because they had been seen together by people out and about, and there was pretty much no doubt that happened, and I think that's why Duane took her disappearance so seriously and started harassing Ralph so bad. Oh, yeah, it was quite the deal.
We think it's important that you know the details of the seemingly convoluted theories about Patty, because it helps give context to the afternoon of October 26th, 1976, not quite 2 months after Patty Otto vanished without a trace. On that day, Ralph went to the Long Branch Saloon in Lewiston, where he had several drinks with a friend and his brother Ray. At one point in the evening, a waiter came to the table and told Ralph that he had a phone call that he could answer at the bar. Ralph got up and went to the bar, and Ray continued talking with Ralph's friend. After talking on the phone briefly, Ralph stepped outside, out of sight of Ray and his friend. While he was outside, Ralph left an envelope of cash inside a pickup truck with California license plates. The cash was a down payment for a professional assassin to kill Lewiston Police Captain Duane Ayler. Next time on Still.
Everywhere we went, there was cops on our tail. They told my husband, who worked for the guard, that he better watch out what he was doing because it meant his job.
Anyone with information pertaining to the disappearance of Patricia Otto should contact the Lewiston Police Department's tip line at 208-298-3939. Anyone with information pertaining to the identity of the Findlay Creek Jane Doe or other information related to that case should contact the Union County District Attorney at da@union-county.org. If you or anyone you know is a victim of domestic abuse, please contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-SAFE. Still is a production of The Reporter's Notebook and Grayson Shaw Media. You can connect with us online at thereportersnotebook.com or via email at info@thereportersnotebook.com. Still was researched, written, and produced by Karen Shaw Anderson. Additional research and script editing provided by Christine Hughes. Original music by Smith Uoso. Additional narration provided by BJ Blackburn. I'm your host and associate producer, Gary Anderson. Special thanks to everyone who graciously provided interviews and helped with our research. We would specifically like to thank the advocates for Patricia Otto and the Findlay Creek Jane Doe Task Force. Like, follow, and subscribe to Still on your favorite podcast platform. And follow us on Facebook or Twitter to join the conversation. Ezekiel 34:16. I will seek the lost, and I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind up the injured, and I will strengthen the weak.